For many of us, the holiday season begins as a period of indulgence and excess and is followed closely by a period of self-evaluation and new resolve, which makes it the perfect time to talk about willpower. And willpower is, in fact, the topic of today's edition of Please Explain. You may be surprised by just how complex a subject it turns out to be. Joining us now is Dr. Walter Michel, the Robert Johnson Niven Professor of Humane Letters in the Department of Psychology at Columbia University. He was trained as a clinical psychologist and then became a social psychologist and a pioneering researcher in the study of self-regulation and self-control. He joins us now by phone from Paris. And in our studio, John Tierney, a journalist and science writer for the New York Times and co-author with Roy F. Baumeister of a book called Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. It's published by Penguin Press. And I'm pleased to welcome both of you to our show.
Thank you.
Oh, and I welcome our audience's participation as well. Our number here is 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Let's begin with you, Walter. When most of us think of willpower, it's usually on rather simple terms, being able to resist something that tempts us. But is there a scientific definition of willpower that tells us a bit more about what it is?
I don't really think that there's a scientific definition of it that anybody would agree on. Willpower is a term that has been very, very unpopular in science. I can tell you what it means for me.
Well, would you prefer delayed gratification?
No, delayed gratification gets at it, but I think what you were saying about the everyday definition in terms of resisting temptations makes a lot of sense to me. But I think it's more than resisting temptations for goodies like chocolate cake or marshmallows. It's also for not doing an automatic, all kinds of impulsive things that really have bad consequences later on. For example, getting into a fight with your spouse and losing control and throwing the eggs at her. Smoking your third pack of cigarettes for the day when you already have lung problems. Or, as in the recent news, checking your chance to be, wrecking your chance to be president of France in order to have a few minutes of sex with the hotel cleaning lady. So that's what it's about for me.
Well, John, wasn't a discussion of self-control more likely to involve philosophers, theologians, and sometimes politicians in the past? When did social scientists first begin looking at willpower, and what were they hoping to learn at the time?
Dr. Michel's experiments with marshmallows pointed the way there, where he discovered that children who could resist the immediate gratification of a marshmallow then went on to do much better in school and lots of other things.
That was really the beginning?
Well, my co-author of the book, Roy Baumeister, got involved in this, and he was intrigued. He'd been studying self-esteem, and then he got interested in self-control, and he and other researchers were very impressed by the marshmallow experiments, showing that the self-control these children had predicted so many good outcomes in life. And then Roy started doing experiments, testing, what does it take to resist a marshmallow or a chocolate chip cookie is where I did one of his famous experiments.
So, Walter, let's go back to the famous marshmallow research study you did in the late 1960s. It began when you noticed something that your preschooler was doing or preschoolers were doing?
Well, it really began when I had three daughters and watched them go quite unable to delay gratification or to engage in any kind of anything that looked remotely like willpower by any definition, to actually becoming kids who were able to do this reasonably and to have adult conversations and to be able to wait their turn and to delay gratification much of the time. And I got fascinated by the process. So I became very interested in studying how is it that many kids manage to do by the time they're five and six what Adam and Eve were unable to do in the Garden of Eden to resist the whole temptations.
The person sitting next to me in the theater who refuses to turn off the cell phone despite the fact that the play has begun.
Well, that's another nice example, yes.
Now, didn't Freud explain all of this with his theory about the id, the ego, and the superego?
Well, he didn't quite explain all of it. He did make a very important point in a paper in which he was talking about the way the transition essentially from id to ego begins and how the the young infant, who in Freud's mind was a bundle of instincts and impulses, begins to be able to delay gratification. And his speculation was that what happens is when the mother has to stop breastfeeding because her attention turns to other things, the infant develops a mental representation. He called it a hallucinatory representation, object of desire, namely the mother and the mother's breast. And that image is what allows the infant to do, quote, time binding, and to make it through the delay period, howling to be sure, until mom comes back again. So I began with an interest in that question and tried to see what kind of images, when kids are waiting, for example, to get two marshmallows later rather than settle for one now, help the 4-year-old and the 5-year-old and the 6-year-old to do it, or make it difficult for the young child to do it. So my interest was entirely not in making a test, but in finding a method to try to understand what goes on in the head of young kids that at least some of the time allows them to delay gratification for the sake of more important future consequences.
But then you discovered that it also became a predictor of future success and stability. Is that always the case? And has anybody followed up on this? We're now over 30 years after the experiment was done.
Well, yes, the follow-ups have actually turned out to be continuous, because when I realized that there is a relationship between seconds of waiting for things like two Oreo cookies or two little pretzel sticks rather than settling for one now, the question, of course, became an interesting one to pursue in a long-term study. And the first thing that we found out about a dozen years after preschool, when we sent around questionnaires and got SAT scores for these kids, was that the seconds of delay time that they were waiting in the original study, in the original procedure, was predicting things like their rated ability to do well cognitively, to cope well socially, to get along with peers and so on, to a remarkable degree. And most impressive, and I think this is really what got a lot of people interested in, it seemed to be highly predictive of higher SAT scores. And yet when you take out the relationship to IQ, you still find these predictions in adolescence. So we kept pursuing it, looked at them again at 27 and 32, and most recently we've been looking at them at 45, and we see two quite stable patterns, one going from consistent delay early in life, ability to delay, to reasonably high levels of self-regulation right into middle adulthood, and a much lower level of delay and self-regulation that's characterizing the other trajectory. But I don't want for a moment to create the impression that kids who don't delay at age 4 are doomed, because there are two other trajectories that we have not yet studied, in which kids begin low and get higher, and another one where they begin high and get lower. So it's clear that delay behavior at age 4 is not a life sentence that predicts everything that's going to happen to the child. Far from it. But there are strong relationships, unusually strong, considering how usually poor predictions from early childhood to later life are.
My guest, Dr. Walter Michaud. Oh, go ahead.
I want to just point out one other thing which to me is impressive, which is that it is not only predictive, but the ability to delay gratification is highly protective. We find that the people who are higher in delay of gratification ability also wind up taking less cocaine, crack recreationally, for example. In studies that we've done in the South Bronx for boys, they wind up doing less aggressive bullying. They develop less body mass index by the time they're in their late 20s and early 30s, and so on. So there appear to be protective effects from having this ability, which actually make a good deal of sense, because by being able to control oneself, it has a ramification for all kinds of social behavior.
My guest is Dr. Walter Michaud of Columbia University, John Tierney of the New York Times, and co-author with Roy F. Baumeister of a book called Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. It is published by Penguin Press, and willpower is the topic on today's Please Explain segment. John, following up on what Walter just said, society tends to judge people harshly when they can't remain faithful to their spouse or can't resist becoming addicted to drugs or even to email. And people who try to sympathize with them are often called bleeding hearts. So should we try to sympathize with these people?
Well, we can sympathize with people because it is the research has shown that most of us overestimate how much willpower we have. And my co-author, Rory Baumeister, his experiments have shown that willpower is this, it's like a muscle that gets fatigued with use. And we don't have an intuitive sense for how much it gets depleted. It gets depleted not only by resisting temptations, but also by making decisions, by exerting self-control. And as you go through the day, it gets fatigued, and it's difficult for
We exercise less willpower as the day goes on?
Well, we suffer from what's called ego depletion. That's what Roy calls it. And basically that you have less, and it's also, he's also found that it's powered by glucose in the bloodstream. So if you're on a diet trying to starve yourself and you don't have glucose, it makes it that much harder to resist temptations.
So decision making is directly related to self-discipline and willpower?
Well, that was one of the surprising findings. You know, they found this thing in an experiment where they tested, they first found this willpower by having people resist chocolate chip cookies. And then they tested them later and found that they scored lower on self-control tests. They couldn't hold their hand as long in ice water and things. Then they found that making decisions did the same thing, that they found people who'd gone shopping in a mall, who'd made a lot of decisions that day, had less self-control for tests. And they did actual real-world experiments in car dealerships and found this.
And could you tell us about the example involving judges in an Israeli prison?
That was a really striking one where it was a parole board in Israel, and they found that they had to decide whether to give parole or not to a prisoner, and they found that in the morning when the judge's willpower was at its highest, and making a decision to release someone takes willpower. I mean, that's a risk to do. It's changing the status quo takes some energy to do that. It's easier to just let things stay as they are. They found that in the morning the chances were much higher of a prisoner getting parole. Then they found these patterns during the day. They're like right before the mid-morning break, the chances went down. Right after it, the judges would have some fruit and a snack. The prisoners, chances went up briefly. Same thing happened after lunch. They're getting that burst of glucose. Suddenly the judge was better able to make a decision.
So give the judge a cookie.
Exactly.
Walter, is it thought that we're born with a certain level of ability when it comes to self-regulation, self-constraint?
I think, Leonard, that there's little question that there are dramatic differences between kids very early in life in how easily they're able to, for example, even at age 9 months, the ease with which they're able to be distracted when they're suffering from internal distress. And I think that the ability to deploy one's attention in a way to self-distract from stress is a very large part of what goes on in being able to delay gratification. The kids in the marshmallow studies who were most successful, for example, are the ones who were able to change this from being a will-powered, let's really try very hard to wait for those two cookies or those two marshmallow situation, to one in which they started picking their noses and playing with their earlobes and then playing with their toes and singing little songs in order to convert the situation from being a stressful and frustrating and really awful one into being a situation that was bearable while keeping at the back of their mind that they're waiting for those things and that there were reasons why they were doing that. So, yes, there are observable differences early in life in the ease with which attention can be strategically employed in order to make these kinds of tasks easier, and also in the way in which the child spontaneously is able to represent the object of desire, by which I mean if they're thinking about the pretzel sticks, tiny little pretzel sticks, in terms of how chewy and salty and crunchy would be to have it, they ring the bell, and it's over. But if they think about them as being like little matchsticks or like little logs, it becomes very easy for them to wait for it. So I think the ability that all human beings have to change how they represent these tempting hot trigger stimuli That's, I think, where, for me, the real power of volition, the real power of agency, the real willpower that a human being is capable of comes in. You know, Descartes said a lot of things about I think, therefore I am. But I think what we now know from cognitive science is, to the degree that we can think differently, we're also able to be different. And by thinking differently about the cookie or the marshmallow or the cigarette or the drink or the drug, one is able to relate to it quite differently.
And this is a topic that you get into in your book too, John, isn't it?
Individual differences. But
right.
This is equal quality. One can teach it.
Some recent studies have shown the same kind of thing that Dr. Michelle talks about in adults, that they had people wear beepers all day and report when they were feeling desires. And there were several different studies, and that showed paradoxically that the people with the best self-control were the ones who exerted less willpower during the day, because they set up, they basically, like those children who distracted themselves from the marshmallow, they set up their lives so they weren't beset by temptations all day long. They didn't go to all-you-can-eat buffets. They didn't walk by the donut shop on the way to work. They gave themselves time to do things. So they actually saved their willpower for emergencies instead of trying to resist every crisis that came along.
My guests are John Tierney, a journalist and science writer for the New York Times, co-author with Roy F. Baumeister of Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. It's published by Penguin Press. And Dr. Walter Michel, the Robert Johnson Niven Professor of Humane Letters in the Department of Psychology at Columbia University and a pioneering researcher in the study of self-regulation and self-control. We'll be back with more and your calls to 212-433-9692, your comments that you have posted on our show page at WNYC.org right after this. We're talking about willpower on today's Please Explain, just in time for the holidays, although you probably have already been trying to deal with the problem. My guests are Dr. Walter Michel and John Tierney, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And before we get to the calls, Dr. Michel, a listener wonders, are you in Paris to study willpower where there are so many temptations? Are you testing yourself?
I'm in Paris because my partner and I have an apartment in Paris, and Michelle Myers, my partner, she and I go every opportunity that we have in order to see what we can do about not resisting foie gras and so on. So I suppose in terms of Raoul Baumeister's ideas, these would be our times for really letting go.
Well, I can't think of a better place to test your willpower. I would just give in. We go to Susan from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I just had a question for your guests. If they, in their research, ever examined the relationship between willpower and procrastination.
John, is that one of the topics that's come up? Because procrastination is tied to willpower, isn't
right,
it?
No, it's, I mean, it's certainly making decisions and avoiding decisions. One thing that happens when people, when they do experiments and people exert their willpower and lose some of it, then they tend to start making, taking shortcuts on decisions or ducking decisions and making sloppy, quick decisions instead of thinking things out, which is a form of procrastination. And, you know, procrastination is just, it's one of the universal vices, you know, like 90% of college students admit to doing it. And
it's not the same thing as restraining yourself.
but it takes self-control to make yourself do it, though. I mean, they're all examples of self-control, of making yourself do something that is not that has a long-term view instead of short-term pleasure but long-term payoff.
Let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Tom from Seabright, New Jersey. Are you there? Okay. I guess he had something else tempted him, and he disappeared. Miriam from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I don't know if you've addressed this before, but 12-step programs like AA and all the 12-step programs really work on the premise of person not having willpower. The first step is saying you're powerless. I was wondering if you addressed this ever with the issue of addiction, because, you know, the success of these programs basically working on the premise of willpower can only go so far when you are addicted to a substance.
And we've got a chapter in our book, Willpower, about 12-step programs, about Eric Clapton and Mary Carr, how they use these 12-step programs to stop drinking. And there's certainly no doubt they talk about a higher power, and one of the things that researchers sometimes call outsourcing self-control. That's one of the great tricks for conserving your own willpower is having other people monitoring you and encouraging you and using that and basically trusting other people in some firm. It's also it's known as bright line rules, that I'll never drink again, and that's a very clear, easy rule to follow. You know, one of the reasons that people have an easier time stopping drinking sometimes than losing weight is that you can't just stop eating, but you can make a very clear rule the way that AA does. I'm not going to drink again today, one day at a time, set a very clear goal and have it monitored by other people.
Walter, in other research, your work has shown that individuals who were similar in average levels of behavior, for example, in their aggression, nevertheless differed predictably and dramatically in the types of situations in which they aggressed. Would that apply to other areas of self-restraint, like whether to eat that last piece of chocolate?
I think there's no question about that. And I think one of the important things to realize about willpower is that people who have the ability to self-control and self-regulate in many areas, for example, to become president of the United States or to become a major figure in world finance, clearly have both the emotional and the intellectual intelligence and the self-regulatory skills to achieve those that kind of eminence and to achieve those positions. So clearly there have to be hot triggers for them. There have to be areas for them in which they are not immune and in which they're highly vulnerable. And I think it has a great deal to do with the fact that there is a difference between the ability to delay gratification and to control oneself and the motivation to do so. And the motivation to do so can be done in by, for example, having an entitlement theory that lets a powerful person believe that they can get away with some of these things and therefore engage in them. So my point is, I think that Roy Baumeister's analogy between willpower and a muscle is a very good one, but it's a very important point to recognize that people who've got a very good willpower muscle are using it some of the time, but by no means all of the time.
Well, there is St. Augustine's famous line, Lord, what was it? Make me chase, but not yet.
But not yet, exactly. Exactly.
Now, what about peer pressure? Because you could have a strong sense of willpower, but then somebody else says to you, you know, just one more drink. And you have a choice at that point, saying no and being unsociable or having that last drink.
Well, I think those dilemmas are particularly serious in adolescence, where the peer pressures become so hugely important. And I think there's no question that the ability to and the willingness, the motivation to resist that is a terribly important aspect of being able to make it through adolescence. But yes, peer pressures and peer support are enormously important in when that muscle doesn't get used.
You wanted to add to that, John?
Well, it's certainly true that you know, there have been studies of different ways now, and there are great new tools for having peer pressure in the right direction. I mean, the 12-step groups are one way, but there are these new digital tools now where people, they tweet their weight, they post when they exercise on Facebook, and there's a website called stick.com where you can make a bet and have someone be a referee. So these are all ways to basically use these new social networks to to get the right kind of peers in. Influencing you instead of leading you astray.
My guests are John Tierney of the New York Times and Dr. Walter Michel of Columbia University. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Amy from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. The guest related self-control to some degree to blood sugar levels, and I can have my blood sugar drops if I eat sugar on an empty stomach, and I notice I'm more. I try not to do that anymore, but I would get more irritable, could have get react angrily, but I don't think I even noticed other kinds of self-control, like not if I'm hungry in the store, you tend to buy more stuff.
Well, do you monitor yourself in that area? You may be doing it without even realizing it.
I tend to be more aware if I'm hungry while I'm shopping.
Mm-hmm.
So
what do you think? And to add to this, another listener wonders about the effect of diabetes, which involves glucose levels.
We talk in the book about diabetes, how in some way the diabetics do have more problems with self-control. And we talk about some stories about a father on the beach with his son where his blood sugar suddenly goes and he suddenly can't even make a decision whether to stand up or not and where to go. What happens, and I'm not surprised the listener isn't sure what happens, because ego depletes, and there aren't really clear, obvious signs of it, that it isn't like one feeling you have. But what tends to happen is that everything tends to affect you more strongly because your self-regulatory mechanisms have changed a bit. And so just things affect you more strongly. I mean, there's also examples we talk in the book about studies of PMS, that basically what happens then is that there's less glucose available for self-control because it's being used for other purposes by the body, and so little things seem more irritating during that time, and diabetes is another example. There are other examples of how changes in diet have affected self-control.
Craig in Brooklyn asks, can people addicted to drugs or sex or food or gambling beat their addiction with willpower, unaided by medical or psychological help? He says, I once read it is possible if the addict suffers some sort of trauma related to their addiction, but does it take disaster, a heart attack, bankruptcy, they used to say hitting rock bottom, for the addicted person to find the willpower to stop?
I mean, I think there are all kinds of examples of addicted individuals who are able to get over the addiction. I think by using the term willpower as if it were some kind of an entity or thing, we can really confuse ourselves. I think whether or not an addict is able to get over a problem, for example, to give up cigarette smoking after an enormous amount of time smoking cigarettes, really requires the ability to and the assistance with making the future consequences, namely the getting the lung cancer and so on, vivid and hot. One of the problems with delayed consequences is they're extremely difficult to visualize and to take very concretely and to make hot and immediate because they're far away and distant. And I think one of the important things in overcoming an addiction is to cool the immediate power of the thing by focusing on heating up the consequences that are in the future. For example, the way I gave up smoking 50 years ago was by visualizing for myself images of what my lungs would look like when the doctor were to tell me that I've got lung cancer. And by actually trying to visualize that and making yourself see that kind of representation in your head when you're pulling at the next cigarette, the cigarette becomes a lot less tempting.
Well, John, you mentioned the 12-step program. What I did to quit smoking, because I had bronchitis, was to keep a pack of cigarettes in a drawer. And I told myself that if I ever got to the point where I was going to go crazy, I could smoke. And every day I would go to that drawer and look at that pack and then put it back. And I did that for a full year, at one day at a time. And eventually I got past it. And
that's amazing. I mean, see, everyone is different.
My sinuses are still ruined.
Now, that's really impressive that you could do that. And I think that gave you a feeling. There is something that happens. I mean, we talk in the book about how Eric Clapton and Mary Carr just one day kind of made this decision somehow, I'm not going to drink anymore after. And it's this odd process that happens where you become convinced that you're not going to do it in the future, that I'm not going to get drunk Saturday night, so I won't have a drink tonight. There's this sort of belief you have that your future self will stick to it. And how that happens is different for everyone. I know when I quit smoking, I just had to get them out of the house. And I would, and when I lapsed, I would just crush the pack and throw it out,
We have two callers asking about the difference, the relation of free will versus determinism. Is this an issue anymore? Is that something that goes back to philosophy and theology?
Well, that's a big issue. It's something that I don't think is going to make an immediate difference if you're trying to figure out what to eat for the holidays. I think you know, I would assume you have free will when you're facing that buffet.
Well, we thank the two of you so much for participating in today's Please Explain Look at Willpower, which brings us to all those other issues, those philosophical issues like free will. But in the end, I get the feeling, as you suggested, Dr. Michelle, there is a certain hardwiring in us all that determines to some degree whether we will be able to apply willpower more than the next person. And it's with great sadness that I'm ending this conversation, because I really would like to keep it going, and we got a lot of wonderful calls. But my thanks to John Tierney of the New York Times, co-author with Roy F. Baumeister of Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength, published by Penguin, and Dr. Walter Michelle of Columbia University. ¶¶